Hello, this is the Archaeology News Weekly, and I'm David Connolly. This news is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resources website. All the stories have been collected from various sources, and to view details in each story, including the source, please see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. And now, the main headlines from around the world are as follows. We start with a BBC Radio 4 programme on rock art called The Drawings on the Wall. An ancient temple well is to be restored in Bulgaria, and UN vandals spray graffiti on Sahara's prehistoric art, igniting an international outcry. People with blue eyes have a single common ancestor, a new study shows, while we also report on prehistoric finds at a British motorway dig. A Neolithic settlement is found in Egypt, and we have a glimpse of the hunter-to-farmer shift in Ohio. Lindau Man goes back to his roots in Manchester, and ancient bones found at University of California excavation are now the subject to a claim for reburial. We have the study of ancient feet suggesting that prehistoric man wore boots, and the original architect could make a Stonehenge comeback. That's the visitor centre, I should say, and not the stones. And finally, 260 Bronze Age axes have been unearthed in England by amateur archaeologists. Archaeologist Dr. George Nash visited five of Western Europe's most significant prehistoric rock art sites to examine whether the modern mind can ever successfully interpret the mysterious graffiti created by our ancestors. Broadcast can be heard on BBC Radio 4 on 92 to 94 FM and 198 longwave, and also via the internet at www.bbc.co.uk/radio4/arts/drawings-on-the-wall, that's all one word, .shtml. The series is as follows, where episode 1 is The Legless Ladies of Cresswell Crags, that's on Sunday, February the 3rd. We then have Graffiti Gorge on Sunday, February the 10th. Irish Illusions on February the 17th. The Masters of Paspardo on February the 24th. And finally, Architecture of Death on March the 2nd. These are all on Sundays at 2:45 PM GMT. You can also hear them again on the internet by using the Listen Again facility. This actually will fit quite nicely in with the vandalism story later on. Italian historians will take part in the restoration of the only temple well in Bulgaria. Scientists have dated it from 1400 BCE. The unique monument is called Pustogurlo, Vein Throat, and is located in Gurlo village in Pernik area. The new resource will be used to build a new road to the temple well to restore the surrounding area and build a hotel complex nearby. The temple well is built in the shape of a cone. In its highest point, the aperture is 2 meters in diameter, and at the lowest point, it widens to 5 meters. On the left side of the temple, there's a trapezoidal section which leads through 3 meters of corridor and then up a twisting ladder to the top. The Pustogurlo temple is now under UNESCO protection. And now back to graffiti. Spectacular prehistoric depictions of animals and human figures created up to 6,000 years ago on Western Saharan rocks have been vandalised by United Nations peacekeepers. Archaeological sites boasting ancient paintings and engravings of giraffes, buffalo and elephants have been defaced within the past 2 years by personnel attached to the UN mission. Graffiti, some of it more than a metre high and sprayed with paint meant for use for marking routes, now blights the rock art at an isolated site known as Devil Mountain, which is regarded by the local Sahrawi population as a mystical place of great cultural significance. Many of the UN graffiti artists actually signed and dated their work, revealing their identities and where they are from. One Croatian peacekeeper scrawled Petar of the Crow Army across a rock face. There's also Cyrillic graffiti from Russian troops and Mahmud from Egypt, as well as Ibrahim, who also foolishly left their names and serial numbers over prehistoric paintings of giraffes. Julian Harston, the UN official responsible for the Western Sahara, said that he was shocked by the vandalism. He said that funds would now have to be sought from the UN cultural organisation UNESCO to see about removing the graffiti. You'd think that they would know better, as believe it or not, these were officers, not squaddies. The extent of the damage is revealed in a report by Nick Brooks of the University of East Anglia and Joachim Soler of the University of Girona in Spain. Mr. Brooks, a climate scientist who runs the Western Sahara Project, has written a blog about his findings, which also shows pictures of the graffiti more than a metre high on the granite rocks. You can see more of that at nickbrooks.wordpress.com. Western Sahara has been at the centre of a bitter dispute since former colonial power Spain pulled out in 1975 and then neighbouring Morocco invaded. People with blue eyes have a single common ancestor, according to new research after a team of scientists had tracked down the specific genetic mutation. It occurred between 6,000 and 10,000 years ago. Before then, believe it or not, there were no blue eyes. Originally, we all had brown eyes, and the mutation affected the so-called OCA2 gene, which is involved in the production of melanin, the pigment which gives colour to our hair, eyes and skin. A genetic mutation affecting the OCA2 gene in our chromosomes resulted in the creation of a switch which literally turned off the ability to produce brown eyes. The switch reduces the production of melanin to the iris, and in effect this turned-down switch dilutes brown eyes to blue. If the OCA2 gene had completely shut down, our hair, eyes and skin would be melanin-less, a condition known as albinism. Eisberg and his team examined mitochondrial DNA from blue-eyed individuals in countries including Jordan, Denmark and Turkey. This genetic material comes from females, so it can trace maternal lineages. What they were able to show is that people who have blue eyes in Denmark and as far away as Jordan all have exactly the same gene change that are all linked to one mutation that makes eyes blue. Out of the 800 people, they have only found one person that this did not fit, and they had a small brown speck in their blue eye. They have all inherited the same switch at exactly the same point of time in their DNA. That genetic switch somehow spread throughout Europe and now other parts of the world. The question really is, why did we go from having nobody on Earth with blue eyes 10,000 years ago to having 20 or 40% of Europeans having blue eyes now? Well, I can't resist it. Don't it turn my brown eyes blue? Just be glad I didn't actually sing that. New evidence of prehistoric life has been discovered during motorway excavations in Merseyside in northwest England. A team of archaeologists found flints and burnt hazelnuts during preparations for a new junction of the M62 road. The archaeological findings date from the Mesolithic to the Bronze Age periods, from around 5000 to 2000 BCE. The artefacts were found while the excavations were being carried out for a new link road at Junction 6 near Huyton. Discoveries of settlements like this are quite common in upland areas like the Peak District, but in lowland places, which have been farmed for centuries and built upon time and again, it is both very unusual and very exciting to the archaeologists. The site is not important enough to block the motorway scheme, and it's once again buried beneath a new £38 million Junction 6 at Tarbuck Island. Gary Hilton, Highways Agency project manager, said, "The Highways Agency takes its responsibility for heritage very seriously, and they're delighted to have found this window into the past. The artefacts will now go on public display at Liverpool's World Museum." A team of US archaeologists have discovered the ruins of a city dating back to the period of the first farmers 7,000 years ago in Egypt's Fayum Oasis. An electromagnetic survey revealed the existence in the Caranus region of a network of walls and roads, very similar to those constructed during the Greco-Roman period. The remnants of the city are still buried beneath the sand, and the full details of the discovery will be revealed in due course. The artefacts consist of the remains of walls and houses in terracotta and dressed limestone, as well as a large quantity of pottery and the foundations of ovens and grain stores. The remains date back to the Neolithic period, between 5,200 and 4,500 BCE. The local director of antiquities, Ahmed Abdel Alim, said the site was just 7 kilometres from Fayum Lake and would probably have lain at the water's edge at the time that it was inhabited. Ohio's Adena culture represents a turning point in state history. Situated between the nomadic hunting and gathering cultures of Northern American Archaic period and the more settled farming cultures of the later woodland period, the Adena culture represented the dawn of a new way of life for Ohio's ancient people. Archaeologists now are fleshing out the details of the daily lives of Ohio's first farmers, who are known mostly for their mortuary and ritual sites, such as the Chillicothe's Adena Mound, from which the culture is named. Archaeologists Craig Keener and Kevin Nye investigated three Adena encampments in central Ohio that show strong continuities with the earlier hunting and gathering ways of life, as well as hints of the changes that, in Asia, are described as the Neolithic Revolution. Their results are reported in the current issue of the Mid-Continental Journal of Archaeology. The three sites are situated in the uplands and likely represent autumn camps focused on gathering and processing nuts. Before this work, most known Adena habitation sites and camps were located along rivers. The upland setting and the focus on nut collection are more of what we'd expect from the archaic period camps. New developments are revealed by the presence of broken pots and, in one pit, a handful of seeds representing the earliest domesticated plants in Ohio: goosefoot, sumpweed, and maygrass. The pottery suggests a less nomadic way of life because the large pots of the Adena were both heavy and fragile. The seeds indicate an increasing commitment to food production rather than simply collection of Ohio's natural bounty. The sites that Keener and Nye studied capture a glimpse of groups on the cusp of change, no longer simply hunter-gatherers and not yet fully committed farmers. Lindau Man is to return to close to the spot where he met his appalling death almost 2,000 years ago. Skull smashed in, strangled and stabbed, and then finally dumped face down in the bog pool which preserved the evidence of his last terrible hours. He's been one of the star exhibits of the British Museum since his discovery in 1984 by peat cutters at Lindau Moss in Cheshire. The museum is now sending him on a year-long loan to Manchester Museum. He's been on display in the Manchester Museum twice before, in 1987 and 1991. Lindau Man, dated from the 1st century CE, is the best preserved ancient body found in Britain, and one of scores of bodies found in bogs across northern Europe, which have provoked exciting debate amongst archaeologists. Like many of the others found across Europe, he was a healthy man in the prime of his life. The remains of his one surviving hand have neatly trimmed nails, and the fingertips show no sign of wear from hard manual labour. Scientists discovered his last meal was a piece of unleavened bread still in his stomach. The jury really is still out on these bodies, whether they were aristocrats, or priests, criminals, or outsiders, whether they went willingly to their deaths or whether they were executed. But Lindau was a very remote place in those days, and so it's unlikely that it was an ambush or a murder. Although the bodies are tanned to leather, they are very fragile and in danger of decay and mould. Lindau Man will be on display in Manchester from April. And I would say that that's very well worth a visit and see one of your ancestors face to face. I actually remember seeing one of the bog bodies up close and personal, and it was a very fascinating insight and humbling as well. Anyway, locked away in a museum safe near Escondido in California, USA, are perhaps the oldest skeletal remains found in the Western Hemisphere. More than 30 years after the relics were unearthed during a classroom archaeological dig at UC San Diego, the country's Kumayai tribe are fighting to reclaim the bones that anthropologists estimate are nearly 10,000 years old. UCLA anthropologist Professor Gail Kennedy thinks it's the oldest multiple burial in the New World. She participated in the 1976 dig with a University of California San Diego professor. We don't know anything about these people other than they lived on the coast and that they were fishermen. The remains, which a UC consultant says have been dated to between 9,590 and 9,920 years old, make them older than Kennewick Man, remains that were found on the banks of the Columbia River in 1996. The Kumaye don't care how old these remains are, they simply want to put what they say are their ancestors to rest. According to members of the Kumaye Cultural Repatriation Committee, which was created in 1998, about 29 remains were excavated in 1996. However, only three in the safe near Escondido are accounted for, and they would like to bury those remains, saying they no longer want them disrespected. The Kumaye say they can prove their link to the remains, but are insulted that they're even being asked. The tribes gave a presentation outlining their centuries-long ties to the area, including maps, historic songs and poems referring to the La Jolla area. This is quite an interesting debate because, of course, do we have a connection with our Bronze Age ancestors in Britain, Christian ancestors, the Romans? I don't know. It's a debate which I think will go on, because one of the main things is, do the Kumaye have a direct connection with the people buried there? And whether or not they do, is it right for us to actually keep these remains? And I remember that it seems that 26 of them have actually already gone missing, if this is the way we're going to treat our common ancestors. Footwear, it seems, has been fashionable for rather a long time. Toe bones from a cave in China suggest people were wearing shoes at least 40,000 years ago. Eric Trinkhouse and Hong Shang from Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, measured the shape and density of toe bones from a 40,000-year-old skeleton found in Tianyuan Cave near Beijing. They compared the bones from those of 20th-century urban Americans, late prehistoric Inuits, and other late prehistoric Native Americans. Shoes alter the way that a person walks. With a rigid sole, the toes curl up far less than when barefoot, and less forces pass through the bones, leading to obvious differences in the three recent populations. Modern shoe-wearing Americans have very little toes, while barefoot Native Americans have strong, large toes. Shoe-wearing Inuits lie somewhere in between. Trinkhouse and Shang found that the Tianyuan toe bones were most similar to the Inuits, indicating that this person regularly wore shoes. British architect Ted Cullinan could make a dramatic return to the Stonehenge Visitor Centre project, 15 years after he was first selected to design a facility there. English Heritage has confirmed it is looking at resuscitating previous visitor centre proposals following the recent demise of Denton Corker Marshall's £60 million scheme. Cullinan is responsible for almost all the old schemes and, after winning the original design competition back in 1993, investigated different plots around the World Heritage Site. The firm, which was eventually ditched in 2000 when incoming English Heritage Chief Neil Cossens announced that he wanted to rethink the procurement process, are back. So the site is 1 kilometre north of the stones, and the great thing is that you can see Stonehenge from the roof of the building, but you can't see the building from the stones. English Heritage wants the centre to be up and running by 2012 to cater for the expected invasion of tourists arriving on the back of the London Olympics. English Heritage will have critical meetings in late January and February with stakeholders and representatives from UNESCO. Well, it's nice to see the London Olympics giving at least part of the south of England an extra heritage boost. It'd be very nice if that could expand to the rest of what we call the United Kingdom. Ooh, nasty there. And finally, three detectorists from Ringwood in Hampshire, England, have unearthed a great number of Bronze Age axe heads in what is one of the largest finds of its kind in Britain. Les Keith, Tom Pierce and Brian Thomas discovered 260 complete axe heads. The finds prompted a search of the area at the farm near Swanage in Dorset by archaeologists. It's believed the axe heads were manufactured at a nearby Bronze Age settlement. As the finds are classed as treasure trove, the proceeds will be split between landowner and the finders. The 4-inch by 2-inch axe heads are being assessed by the British Museum, which may buy them. Dr. Andrew Fitzpatrick of Wessex Archaeology said, "It is one of the largest and important finds of its kind because of its size and condition. The artefacts could have been used as a form of currency and buried at a time of crisis, but many people believe they were buried as an offering to the gods. A lot of Bronze Age objects like this were buried in the ground, and it's a bit of a coincidence that people didn't go back for them." Well, that just goes to show you that with recording and cooperation, we can all benefit. That's the members of the public, detectors and archaeologists, if we all act responsibility. So it's a lesson to us all that there should be a bit more cooperation between archaeologists and detectorists. Take note, archaeologists. Can I remind people that many new archaeological and heritage employment opportunities, as well as a UK Heritage Calendar, Library and Guidance section, can be found on a newly revamped Badger, www.bajr.org. Also, our sister company Past Horizons has a cracking archaeology volunteer site at pasthorizons.com, and we both have cracking blogs as well. You'll find them just by Googling either BAJR blog or Past Horizons blog. And remember, of course, that more can always be found at the excellent Stone Pages, the inspiration for this podcast news after all. news.stonepages.com. Thank you very much for listening to this Archaeology News Weekly. We hope you'll return to us next week.